Free Talk Live.
Welcome to Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. I'm Gardner Goldsmith, the creator of the Liberty Conspiracy, which you can watch every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. live on Rumble, Rockfin, and my Twitter X feed at Gard Goldsmith. You can also check us out anytime after the fact, of course, because the recordings will be at Rumble and Rockfin. And please feel free to visit my Substack, where every Sunday you'll find the Sunday News Assembly, 20 stories plus, and you'll also find video segments as well, all of it pertaining to liberty, allowing us to derive long-standing lessons from some of the breaking news stories. And of course, you can find my work at mrctv.org, the Media Research Center's TV arm. And I want to thank you very much for tuning in to this night of Free Talk Live, combining with Liberty Conspiracy. We open the program with an analysis of the oral arguments in the Murthy v. Missouri Supreme Court case about government censorship through social media giants. It's a massive story and perhaps one of the most consequential stories for free speech that has popped up in the United States in the past 100 years. Thanks so much for tuning in, everybody. What's on tap, one and all? Well, of course, we're going to the courts, everybody. So we need to hear from our pals in black and white land. Perry, where are you? Guys are sitting there like, free speech? No way. Get out of here. All right. Let's get rolling, everybody. Okay. So we're going to start things off, of course, with quick coverage on what's going on in the Supreme Court. And there was another very big case today, the National Rifle Association of America versus Volo. But we're not going to go into that one today because the dominant one, and I just focus my attention on this case, the Murthy versus Missouri case. This was the big one that has been brewing for more than 2 years now. It's huge, and I've been writing a lot about it. And even prior to it, I could sort of see it coming. That's why for MRCTV, I did a lot of concentration on Section 230, and even here on the show, I talked a lot about Section 230 of the 1996 Telecommunications Act because it is pertinent. And I knew it was going to be pertinent. And sure enough, it was pretty much the core underlying monster behind it all, hiding behind the fog, was the regulatory power that the federal government claims over anybody who is involved with the internet or broadcasting, over radiated waves, or telecommunications over the phone lines. Section 230, 1996 Telecommunications Act, ISPs and stuff like that. So let's show you a quick one from Elena Erskine as this came up in the morning, 9:56 a.m. And you might have seen it at 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The justices will hear oral arguments in Murthy versus Missouri and the National Rifle Association of America v. Volo. Okay, now over at the SCOTUS blog, if you visit the SCOTUS blog a lot, and who doesn't? Who doesn't, huh? Yeah, I'm saying, you know, when you're going on a day like, hey, baby, you want to check out my SCOTUS blog? Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Come on over here. Yeah, we'll scroll through it and have a great time. Yeah, anyway, maybe there are some people. That would be awesome if I could find a young lady who was interested in some of this stuff, too. And I do know a couple, which is kind of nice. Very good people. So anyway, not that you're going to start a relationship, but it's good to know some people are interested in this stuff. So Elena Erskine wrote that, and I want to go over to at least one of the pop publications that covered this. We'll go to Politico. On their list over at SCOTUS blog, this will show you, they had like NPR, NBC, CNBC, you know, CNN, and Politico. Oh, gee, I wonder if I might get pretty much the same message from them all. I don't know. How strange. Anyway, here it is. The echo chamber erupts. Supreme Court to hear online speech case with major 2024 implications. The case involves claims that the Biden administration censored conservative speech, and any ruling could impact all government dealings with digital platforms on the fall elections. Okay, first of all, I got to mention that it's not just claims that the Biden administration censored conservative speech. This is proven. This is proven, documented. I was writing about it before the Twitter files came out. The Twitter files came out. They were censoring political speech and engaging in their own propaganda and paying people without the public knowing. That's what they were doing. This is not claims. This is verified by internal documents and even statements of the politicians and even people inside in their own notes involved with the so-called COVID pandemic response, right? They were engaged in this stuff very clearly. So anyway, that's what is at stake. A lot of people were involved in this. RFK Jr. was involved in this. The cases were combined for a while, then they renamed it. It's been quite a ride here. Also, the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, as I mentioned to you about maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, Dr. Peter McCullough mentioned that they have gotten involved. They're sort of the free market alternative to the American Medical Association. And I think my first nationally published article was actually published by them. It's essentially a journal, so I didn't really categorized into my head as like being published by a magazine. The first magazine was The Freeman from Foundation for Economic Education. So, okay, if you want some background on this, let's go over here to a 2022 piece that I wrote for MRC TV. Civil rights defenders sue, claiming Biden administration pushed big tech censorship. So I've been covering this a lot. I feel like I'm okay to be a go-to person tonight on this and sort of break this apart. Now, monitor the statements. Got some stuff to play for you, and it's a lot of stuff. The show is going to be different tonight because we're going to be playing these statements and breaking these things down, not just pertaining to the actual case itself and whether or not the things we're hearing from the government or the claims from the plaintiffs are verified or whether or not they're shadings of things, but the statements of some of the justices, like I said, very key because Ketanji Brown Jackson not only was involved with asking questions that reveal her biases, but she actually was projecting, she was radiating a message while she was there because I think she knew the media was going to pick it up. Wait till you hear this. I mean, she was continuing to push the Biden, the Trumper, deep state members and deep staters for ages line, the pop media line, that censorship is somehow allowable and valid based on the, of course, consequentialist idea that a single person's speech can be completely destroyed and it won't put anybody else's speech at risk and it will somehow benefit everyone based on the political entity in power and what they think is benefit. It's incredible. So here it is. I'm going to play you this video that came out March of 2022, almost 2 years ago to the date. And you can let me know what you think about this. It should be all queued up. Here we go. The anti-rights, anti-speech combo of big government and their ideologically aligned, morally empty big tech accommodators has been spreading the viral violence of politicized anti-science lockdowns and censorship for years. But now, has the Biden administration finally gone too far in actually calling for Twitter and social media to silence us? A new lawsuit says yes. Hi, everyone. I'm Gardner Goldsmith for MRC TV. You know, since the start of the government will define science and big tech will follow mania surrounding COVID-19 and the insane political attacks on our rights, many MRC TV friends might have asked themselves how the government media nexus could repeatedly revise their claimed reality and simultaneously claim that those of us who have been right from the start were still wrong. Others might have realized that the matter of consistency wasn't the key, that it was all about power.
Or, as Lewis Carroll said about propagandistic politicians and truth in Alice in Wonderland, quote, the question is, which is to be master? That is all. Now, there's a new battle on that front of speech, a battle that follows up on a report about government-defined so-called truth and big tech that I got to write for MRC TV on March 8th. On March 24th, a civil rights group representing three people silenced by Twitter announced that they're suing the Biden administration for pushing that censorship. The suit, brought by the New Civil Liberties Alliance, NCLA, on behalf of Michael P. Singer, Mark Shengizi, and Daniel Kotzin, accuses Surgeon General Vivek Murthy and Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra of pressuring Twitter to silence the accounts of each plaintiff after they posted information that diverged from one of the many changing versions of so-called government science. As Greg Piper reports for Just the News, quote, the government's sustained pressure on social media platforms to censor and report purported COVID-19 misinformation amounts to state action that violates the First Amendment, according to a lawsuit filed Friday on behalf of three Twitter users. And there are two major Bidenista periods of action on which the NCLA focuses. The first is the one on which I reported on March 8th. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy's fascist call on social media and tech carrying instant messaging to cite the total number of what they called misinformation posts that they carried on their platforms. Quote, Twitter suspended Kotzin temporarily and Singer permanently within a week of Surgeon General Vivek Murthy's March 3rd request for information, RFI, on the impact and prevalence of health misinformation in the digital information environment during the COVID-19 pandemic, including how it affects likelihood to vaccinate, end quote. That move was easy to understand as not only an attempt to intimidate tech platforms into shutting down dissent, but also as a targeting device to prompt individuals to self-censor. After all, despite Murthy claiming that the instances in which people posted misinformation would be aggregated and thus anonymized, in order to confirm that the statistics were real, the government would have to have confirmation of the identities of each person who released the so-called errant post. Piper continues offering key information about the fight against the Surgeon General. Quote, Murthy is exceeding the statutory power of his office, which lets him quarantine individuals reasonably believed to be infected and communicable to prevent interstate transmission. NCLA claims it's the same legal basis the Supreme Court ruled ineligible for the CDC's COVID eviction moratorium, end quote. And of course, the deeper issue of whether the CDC is either constitutional, good luck finding it in the Constitution, or is an ethical construct at all, because, of course, you're being forced to pay for a gang of bureaucrats. And I don't see that as exactly ethical. Well, that wasn't addressed by the Supreme Court, but the majority did rule that the CDC has no statutory power to ban evictions and, of course, become the de jure landlord of post-rights respecting America. But this is a valuable contribution to the fight for citizens to claw back some of their remaining rights about speech. The fact that people such as plaintiff Daniel Kotzin were deplatformed for posting information with which the feds themselves actually agreed merely adds fuel to the free speech fire. As lawyer Jenin Yonas tweeted March 8th, quote, Daniel Kotzin has been suspended for the tweet below, a view shared by most epidemiologists, Rochelle Walensky, the vaccines don't stop transmission, and Anthony Fauci, everyone will get COVID. I'll just leave that there. And she included a screenshot of Twitter shutting down a post from Kotzen in which he had said, quote, "It is important to never lose sight of the fact that the global pandemic is ending not because of the vaccines, wink, wink, but because almost everyone got infected with COVID," end quote. And that's just the latest wrinkle in the nasty face of this sneering, leering, big brother treatment of free speech. The other aspect of the suit goes back to spring and summer of last year, and even further when looking at the deep roots of government claims to control the internet. As Piper points out, quote, "The suit says the unconstitutional state action started with statements by the White House in May and HHS in July. Press Secretary Jen Psaki implied President Biden would take antitrust actions against tech platforms if they didn't censor vaccine misinformation, while Murthy issued an advisory on building a healthy information environment." The phrasing resembles that used by Chinese state media, end quote. Not a surprise. Perhaps they caught a censorship flu from China that, of course, was funded by U.S. tax money. Continuing, quote, "Tech platforms will be held accountable for people who reject COVID vaccines and masking and use unproven treatments," Murthy said. "They must increase monitoring of purported misinformation, crack down on super spreaders and repeat offenders, and amplify information from trusted and credible sources and subject matter experts." As the lawsuit notes, quote, "They again directed much of their ire towards social media platforms, which they largely blamed for the problem of ostensible misinformation, ordering social media companies like Twitter to remove certain posts and ban certain users." Statements made by Murthy, Psaki, and President Biden made clear that these were not requests, but demands, and that the administration was contemplating penalties against social media platforms for allowing misinformation to be disseminated on them, end quote. These Biden underling threats encompass an overall mentality that is enshrined in Section 230, which shields online hosts from being called publishers and being targets of state-level action concerning things like posts that might contain child pornography or threats or depictions of violence. The section also shields the tech hosts from civil liability against slander or libel suits from something that might have been posted on their platforms. The key is that the section does allow hosts to eliminate posts and still be called platforms rather than publishers, as long as the hosts do so in good faith. That's in quotes. Good faith, of course, is determined by the FCC. If the FCC doesn't think you operated in good faith, they can go after you. And so can state governments, as well as individuals who might have been harmed by, a slanderous post. So these threats of further action by Biden officials easily can be viewed as warnings implying changes in how the feds view the good faith clause of Section 230 and whether they think the hosts are operating that way. Mm-hmm. It's a threat that can inspire censorship on the part of the hosts like Twitter. Deeper still, we need to look at the question of the FCC itself, because that's the omnipresent, always existing threat against anybody who does anything online. We have to look at the questionable constitutional foundation of the FCC in the first place, which began as the Federal Radio Commission in the 1920s under the suspicious claim that radio waves cross state borders and that there's a limited spectrum of slots for broadcasters. But as James Madison said, the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution, found in Section 1, Article 8 of the Constitution, was not written to grant the feds power to control things that went over state borders. It was written to allow Congress to mediate state versus state trade disputes. To say that Congress can create an agency to regulate radio because content crosses borders in multiple states, well, that's akin to saying Congress can create a federal book commission because booksellers sell in multiple states. And to claim that the radio spectrum is limited, therefore the feds must claim ownership and then license people to use the bands, well, that's akin to saying that there's only a limited number of usable trees on the planet at any given time, and that therefore paper is limited and newspapers and books have to be controlled by the government. This lawsuit is very timely, and I believe it reveals a lot, shedding light on the fascistic tactics of the Bidenistas and on the U.S. government going back to the creation of the Federal Radio Commission. But the fascism often gets overlooked. It's been around for over a century, and I thought it would be important to share the information with you, stemming from this current story going all the way back to the 1920s. Thanks so much for watching, everybody. Remember, if you're watching on YouTube, we'll see you there in the comments section, but we've been getting great response also on Rumble. Absolutely fantastic to see all the people heading to Rumble.
Absolutely. And yes, I'm very appreciative of everybody who joins and follows Liberty Conspiracy on Rumble. We have a Liberty Conspiracy channel on YouTube, but I don't go live there because I play musical cuts. I would probably get hit with a copyright strike. And whether I get hit or don't get hit by YouTube might even depend on whether they like the other content that I put out there. If they were in favor of my collectivist side, if I were to put that out there somehow, if I had one, I don't have a collectivist side. But if I were to promote collectivism, they probably wouldn't give me a copyright strike unless they really got pushed by some of the recording companies. But otherwise, they would use it as an excuse, as a justification to tear me down. So with that stated, everybody, let's go back over into what is on tap tonight and go into this major story in just a minute. Free Talk Live is brought to you by Dash Digital Cash. Dash is the cryptocurrency made for spending. You can pay your bills with Dash at spritz.finance. Plus, they can send dollars to your bank if you still need those for something. Thanks to the Dash DAO for sending us 32 Dash per month for this sponsorship. It's easy to get and use Dash. You can learn more at Dash.org. That's Dash.org.
On Free Talk Live, we're bringing people to the ideas of liberty every day. From wrestling superstars like Glenn Jacobs.
You guys really are having an impact, I believe. Like I said, a lot of where I am now is due to listening to Free Talk Live. You changed my mind on some very important issues years ago.
To random people tuning in on the radio.
I was kind of stuck in the left-right paradigm. I heard your show by chance on a Saturday night. From there, I went on joined the Free State Project and become an amplifier. So, I mean, that's really the reason why I amp is because I know that if it wasn't for you guys being on as many stations as you are, I never would have found the ideas of liberty.
You can help more people hear the message of liberty by joining Free Talk Live's AMPS program on Patreon for as little as $5 a month. And you'll get access to special perks. Visit amps.freetalklive.com, amps.freetalklive.com.
Free Talk Live. We return with Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Find Liberty Conspiracy every Monday through Friday at Rumble, Rockfin, and my Twitter /X feed at Guard Goldsmith. And, of course, I invite you anytime to subscribe free over at my Substack. And remember, every Sunday you'll find at least 20 news stories plus video links pertaining to freedom. And I get to add contextual information that hopefully will help break apart those news stories and let us derive intellectual ammunition to take with us for future situations that are similar. Let's continue with Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. So let's go into the oral arguments in the cases, the background. We've got the background. Okay. Now let's go into the oral arguments and watch Kagan and especially watch Ketanji Brown Jackson. Now, there's some positives here. I thought Sam Alito was very good. This isn't like a movie review or some sort of sports review. Like, he was at the top of this form, dude. I'm so glad I put him on my fantasy baseball team. But let me give you a little heads up here. If you get the opportunity, you can head over to C-SPAN, because C-SPAN has their coverage. And it's about an hour and 43 minutes of the majority of the oral arguments from that day. They might have missed something after lunchtime. I'm not exactly sure. But it was very interesting checking that out. And I want to go through this now with you from the start with the Biden administration's arguments coming out and the questions that came from a number of the justices. And as we go through this, keep in mind there are a number of terms such as moderation, and that is equivalent to basically curation, which is the term that you'll find in the 1996 Telecommunications Act for Section 230. Also, keep in mind as you listen to this, the arguments that have come up about Marsh v. Alabama, the 1946 Supreme Court ruling. Now, they don't go into it here, but just remember that the practical outcome of taking something that is private property that the owner opens to a large number of people under the owner's decision of what is acceptable or what is not acceptable, if one supports the idea that that must be open to everyone, that person also supports the idea that the government is deciding that. Right. That's generally what we're talking about. We're talking about Supreme Court decision, one who favors the Marsh v. Alabama decision. Typically, we see that folks who favor that say, if you're going to be open to people coming in, and Marsh v. Alabama was about this shipbuilding company in Alabama, and they had a campus for their employees with little cabins and a post office and a little store and stuff. And a woman was promulgating some of her religious material. They asked her to leave. She wouldn't leave. They called the police. They cited her for trespass. And she went to the Supreme Court on it. The Supreme Court magically just invented out of nowhere the idea that, well, if you open it up to a large number of people, it's public property, which clearly destroys the difference between what is public property, tax funded, and what is private. What incorporates the tragedy of the commons, because it forces everybody to pay for it at different levels and so on and so forth. But everybody thinks they've got a claim on it, and the ratios are never equaled out in any way, because, of course, people would say that that just favors the rich, of course, who will get taxed more anyway. But that is public property. Private property is that which is owned by individuals or groups of individuals who get together. Now, I'm pulling away the idea of asking for corporate status, the incorporation stuff that the government grants people. But just this general moral question of what is private and what is public, there's a stark difference. And private property must be hands off from the state. But the Marsh v. Alabama decision changed that. And all of a sudden destroyed all the barriers against private property. If there had been walls there, they pulled them down. And that led to the Americans with Disabilities Act. That led to the 64 Civil Rights Act, the public accommodations portion of it. That led to Title IX. That led to the ADA under George H.W. Bush, the Americans with Disabilities Act, where literally there were restaurants that actually went out of business because they couldn't do the ramps right and they had to keep spending money on it. They were going to put wheelchair ramps in for strippers at strip clubs. I mean, just absurd stuff. But again, those absurdities are just the outward face of the inner rot of the Marsh v. Alabama decision in all of its manifestations. And it destroys private property. It destroys the concept of free association and free will. Key things that Walter Williams used to discuss all throughout his career. Thomas Sowell talks about these things. And so it's important to keep this in mind, because this is exactly what happens. What we see right now, this debate, if it is found, if someone agrees that an online platform is like that shipbuilding campus, it's a public place, even though it should be run privately, even though I know the people at YouTube said that they are the public sphere, they're the public commons, even if they say that, it doesn't mean that. It just says that they're saying that. And it doesn't mean you can apply that concept to other people who don't agree with that, right? If they want to be open to everybody, they can be open to everybody, while somebody else who's very, very big also can put up barriers to say no. Like I said, if Elon Musk wants to run a chat platform or a posting platform that's only for Christians or only for Satanists or Baphometists or whatever, he could do so, right? And they can have restrictive language on those things. Just like if I open up my home to a party and I say, okay, I want everybody to wear orange clothes to the party. It's an orange party, right? It's the Scots-Irish, right? So that's my stipulation. If you're not wearing it, get out. This is my place, not your place. So all those things are impositions that invade the concept of private property. They destroy the good balance between neighbors, the neighborly interactions that people have. And they claim for the government the power to control things. They destroy private property, right? Okay. So essentially, you have communism, you have socialism hiding behind the 64 Civil Rights Act and the public accommodations portion of it. You have all sorts of logical questions that arise, as I've often mentioned. If you're in a 99.9% racist-free town, but there's one person in there who's a skinhead Nazi, and he doesn't like Jews or doesn't like, you know, black people or whatever, right? Does that mean that you then, as a customer with your property, must share the opportunity and frequent his place, or that you have to let him into your shop? That you have to do business with him? What if you don't want to, right? It's just like the government forcing you to pay taxes that are going to go to slaughter Gazans, Palestinians in Gaza. You can't stop them. They'll kill you eventually if you resist hard enough. You don't want to go to jail for not paying your taxes? Well, they'll send armed people to come get you. You resist the armed people? Well, they're, of course, going to call you the aggressor and kill you, right? That's what they do. It's the whole concept of the state is a massive gaslighting thing. That's all it is. If you resist and ask to be left alone, you're the bad guy. You're the wrongdoer. You're the aggressor. It's amazing. So this is very important to keep in mind, that Marsh v. Alabama decision from 1946. If people agree that private property that caters to a lot of people must be opened to everybody, well, what they're actually agreeing is it's going to be policed by some political entity, and that throws the power not towards your preference that it's going to be open to everybody, but it just depends on whom the government. You're not going to be able to stop them if they start to restrict things, if they don't make it everybody. You're not going to be able to stop them. It will always trend towards the government favoring certain people. That's the way it's going to work for the public good, as they say, right? Because some people must be culled. They're dangerous, as we saw with the COVID stuff. The very modus operandi, the very crimes that were perpetrated against people like you and me stem from the mindset that accepts the Marsh v. Alabama concept. It must be questioned. Any ethical person must resist it. Because the state getting involved and so-called opening the doors to everybody means the state controls the doors and they can shut them for their purposes. And this is exactly what we saw with the government getting involved. And what's interesting in this is when you hear this first oral argument, you're going to hear the government's defense here, right? The government doesn't get into some of the details on those very obvious statements of Joe Biden saying that he's going to use antitrust and things like that, right? They don't even get into that. They're just arguing that somehow, get this, and you're going to hear one of the justices talk about it, there was a compelling state interest to silence people. Public health, silence the individual. We're making it up, whatever the compelling state interest is. So with that preface, let's get into it. We're going to roll with this, and I'm going to pause it occasionally for my commentary, your commentary, Rockfin X, and of course, the mighty Rumble team. And again, thank you. I know Friedan is over in Rumble. I didn't see if Friedan's also in Rockfin too, but thanks again, Friedan. I really appreciate it. And Risha's been there. So let's go with this, everybody. Here we are. They've got the lineup. It's like a baseball team. It's kind of sad. I don't know. Who's the shortstop? I don't know. Who's on first? I don't know. No, I don't know who's on second. No, I don't know who's on third. Okay, so here we go. This is the opening coming from the Biden administration making their oral argument. Here we go.
Well, your argument first this morning in case 23-411, Murphy versus Missouri. Mr. Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
All right, so if you're just listening, folks, that was John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts. I won't do that all the time. It's because he pretty much, Brian Fletcher, just goes back and forth with different people. But I will mention the person, if you're just listening in audio streaming or after the fact on our podcast, Brian Fletcher. He's the U.S. Principal Deputy Solicitor General. And you get to pay his salary to get him to work to silence you. Let's go. You get to pay everybody's salary. That's awesome. Yes, the overlords. Isn't it a strange commentary on the so-called land of the free that nine people can decide after they hear the arguments of an also government-paid lawyer and people who had to shell out their own money to try to fight this stuff? They'll decide about your free speech rights. Isn't that great? Land o' the free. It's like Land O' Lakes. They remove the Indian and still call it the same product.
May not use coercive threats to suppress speech, but it is entitled to speak for itself by informing, persuading, or criticizing private speakers.
Okay, so I'm just going to go back there for you, okay? So he's saying that they're not entitled to silence people, but they are entitled to speak for themselves. So that goes towards the attempt to have an injunction to block the Biden administration to stop them from silencing people, working with social media. In other words, what they call working with, threatening, having behind the everything, the fist behind the back saying, I'm going to punch you if you don't work with us. Section 230, we're going to remove some of the protections, antitrust suits, we're going to lose all those things, right? Those are what are hiding behind the curtain. And it takes a while, but you're going to hear a couple of the conservative judges saying, hey, with this hiding back here, isn't this basically an implicit threat? Yeah, it is. It is. And you're also going to hear the Solicitor General talking about how the online services like Facebook and so on, they volunteered. They wanted to make sure they were putting good information out there. Well, why do you think they promoted the idea that they were only going to make sure that there was good information out there? Because they had already heard the threats from the government. That's why. Let's continue. Here we go. Amazing. Just amazing. Because they were trying to conform with what the government people would say was good. We all know this. If you got censored, you know what was driving the whole thing. And of course, some of it was ideological. They also were pushing the idea of collectivism, lockdowns as being you must conform. But a lot of it on the business side was we don't want to deal with the FCC. We don't want to deal with getting Section 230 and massive lawsuits. So here we go.
Well, your argument first this morning in case 23-411, Murphy versus Missouri. Mr. Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The government may not use coercive threats to suppress speech, but it is entitled to speak for itself by informing, persuading, or criticizing private speakers.
Okay, so let's just stop right there and just say, what is the FCC but an omnipresent, always extant coercive threat? Period. He just stated the argument against the very existence of the FCC. But we'll continue because, of course, people overlook that because it's already assumed that the FCC can exist. It's existed as the FRC since 1920, as you saw in the preview video.
Like Bantam Books, this case should be about that fundamental distinction between persuasion and coercion.
All right. So he says, like Bantam Books, that's key. We'll go into the Bantam Books thing very, very quickly. What is the Bantam Books decision? Okay. The Bantam Books decision is from 1963. It's Bantam Books Incorporated v. Sullivan. And this is the story from First Amendment MTSU.edu. Okay. In Bantam Books Incorporated v. Sullivan, The Supreme Court ruled that states must provide adequate, according to the federal government's rules, adequate procedural safeguards when establishing a mechanism to declare books obscene. Okay, now again, based on the First Amendment, it is Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. States can, but you have to check their constitution. This is one of the reasons why I try to stress this federalist concept, the original concept of federalism, not under the Hamiltonian idea of federalism, the confederated idea that the states are not listed in the First Amendment. Congress is listed in the First Amendment, but of course, they pay no attention to that anymore. The court's decision favored a group of book publishers who were suing a state commission created to take preventative action to stop juvenile delinquency. Part of the commission's responsibility was, quote, to educate the public concerning any book or other thing containing obscene, indecent, or impure language that could corrupt youth. So what we're discussing here, folks, is the prerogative or power of a state to put out information versus the power of the state to silence individual information. Now, the prerogative of the state to put out information is also a very big part of this case in Murthy, right? Because it opens up a can of worms and you get into an almost infinite regress of wondering, okay, if the state is forcing me to pay for the state, this is a basic philosophical question. We often would discuss this in class. If the state is forcing me to pay for the state, they're taking away part of my ability to be able to publish my own speech, take time off to speak and things like that, right? Publish my own speech and things like that, right? To fund what I think might be important, that sort of thing. Okay. They are then translating that money into their own speech, right? And that speech always, by definition, because it comes from the polis, is by definition political. It's an irrefutable fact. It's just logic, right? Now, some people can say it has more of an immediate political impact on a particular issue, but it always is funded and pushed by political means. Now, it can have an agenda beyond the mere existence of the state. It can have an agenda pushing something like, oh, I don't know, calling people who are critical of the state of Israel policies, calling them anti-Semitic, or putting out information about jabs that's fake, or doing something about, oh, Russian propaganda that also is fake, right? Whatever it is, right? You can just check into what the NSA and CIA have been doing for 70 years, right? So, with that stated, you can actually get down to an infinite regress where somebody who operates for the state says, well, look, if you're saying that the state, especially the federal government, is impinging on your right to free speech by taking your money, then what you're actually saying is that the state can say nothing. So they're drawing a distinction here between the state engaging in what is recognizably overt, on hand, prima facie, in the moment, political speech to push out a particular agenda, like get the jab, you know, this coming from the Ad Council, or, you know, fight for the army, be all you can be, or whatever, right? Those types of things, to put that information out to promote the government, and even to the point of just issuing reports. Their argument essentially here is, if the state, they're saying the state was only engaged in promoting the good things that the state promotes, just like issuing a paper about how many people are in the military, or the fact that there's going to be an Easter egg roll at the White House. We have to have some way to get this information out. And if you are going to prevent us from putting out our message on Facebook about how wonderful the jabs are, well, that would make all the other functions of the government impossible to do too. How could the president even print up an executive order on a piece of paper? So what they're doing is they're trying to really blur the what most people would see as the basic functions of government in a limited sense of issuing simple reports about what it's doing and how the government mixes in propaganda, of course, to fight the COVID so-called pandemic. Got to get that information out on Facebook. How can you put an injunction against the CDC putting out all this information? And then they mix in, don't you dare listen to those other people over there who are telling you lies. You might have heard this, but so it becomes propaganda. It always becomes that, because if there's a different opinion out there, they're going to be attracted to trying to fight that different opinion because it questions the validity of what they're saying, right? So there's always going to be a tendency to make the government message a fist against whatever the message is that opposes it. So this is where in the oral arguments here, this is where they're trying to draw some sort of distinction between a state offering information about what is seen as offensive and actually shutting something down. But if you look at it logically and you draw out all the logic, they're already, by taking your money, shutting down your opportunities. They're increasing your opportunity costs to try to do what you wanted to do before, whether it's publishing something that you might think they might think is pornographic or you don't think is pornographic, right? Because to them, we COVID denialists, the we jab denialists, well, we were akin to, you know, terrible porn, right? We were putting people's lives at risk. It was the same emergency mindset. So by taking this case from all these years ago, from 1963, we can see this mindset, this blurring of, well, the government of this state was merely engaging in trying to put forward the definitions of pornography, while Bantam Books found that offensive. So there has to be some fine line between shutting down a publishing company and offering a different opinion. But that different opinion is coming from the government. It's propaganda. It's always propaganda. Everything the government does is propaganda. It always is. Even when it's telling you that the White House opens at 9 a.m., that's propaganda. They're propagating a government line. Now, it might be seen as pretty much neutral, but it's not neutral to the taxpayer who might say, you know, I'd rather spend my money on getting a cup of coffee than funding you guys to tell me what time you open, right? So this is very key. Again, I'm going to repeat this Bantam Books thing and go back to the opening argument that they offer, because this is very, very important here. Okay, so this distinction here is quite interesting. They say, part of the commission's responsibility in this state of New York was to, quote, educate the public concerning any book or other thing containing obscene, indecent, or impure language. So are they just informing? Are they targeting? Right? The commission of New York carried out this responsibility by threatening the distributors of material deemed to be objectionable with prosecution in an attempt to suppress obscene material. In its fact-finding capacity, the trial court found the commission's attempted suppression to have been successful. And of course, you can't do that. The federal government, under their argument, does not want to be seen as falling under the Bantam Book standard, because that clearly showed that the state was involved in trying to shut somebody down. But they didn't go into the deeper question. There's a lot more Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live coming up.
This hour of Free Talk Live is brought to you by Dash Digital Cash. Dash is the cryptocurrency designed to be used for spending. Rising fees have made Bitcoin useless for purchases, but Dash continues to have fees less than 1 cent per transaction, and its features ensure Dash is undefeated as the most useful cryptocurrency in the marketplace. From a technical standpoint, Dash transactions are irreversible and its network is protected from 51% attacks by their Chainlocks technology. There's no need to wait for a confirmation before considering a Dash transaction complete, so it's great for merchants. Dash is one of the oldest cryptocurrencies and is widely available on exchanges, including the decentralized Maya protocol, and in multi-crypto wallets. It's easy to get and use Dash. Start by learning more at Dash.org. Big thanks to the Dash DAO for sending us 32 Dash per month to promote Dash on the air. Visit Dash.org to learn about Dash. Dash.org. We'll be right back.
Talk Live.
We return at Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. You can find Liberty Conspiracy Live every Monday through Friday on Rockfin, Rumble, and my Twitter /X feed. That's at Gard Goldsmith, G-A-R-D Goldsmith. And please feel free to check out the Gardner Goldsmith Substack, where you'll find lots of news and information, the Sunday News Assembly with 20 stories pertaining to liberty, at least 20, plus video links, and of course, contextual information to help unwrap those onions of politics and get to the roots of things. And here in this segment, I want to continue with our conversation, looking into the oral arguments about the Murthy v. Missouri Supreme Court case. And in this case, we're investigating some of the context from decades ago about what might have been a precedent where the state of Rhode Island tried to stop certain books being published by Bantam Books within the state of Rhode Island. That was part of the discussion inside the Supreme Court. It's a minor part, but it is interesting and it is kind of important to check out before we get into some of the crazy statements from some of the Supreme Court justices and other statements that actually might comport a little bit more to their oaths to their Constitution. We'll check it all out and look at deeper lessons of freedom right here on Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Thanks for listening, everyone. They say part of the commission's responsibility in this state was to, quote, educate the public concerning any book or other thing containing obscene, indecent, or impure language. So are they just informing? Are they targeting? Right? The commission carried out this responsibility by threatening the distributors of material deemed to be objectionable with prosecution in an attempt to suppress obscene material. In its fact-finding capacity, the trial court found the commission's attempted suppression to have been successful. And of course, you can't do that. So the federal government, under their argument, does not want to be seen as falling under the Bantam Book standard, because that clearly showed that the state was involved in trying to shut somebody down. But they didn't go into the deeper question. And that's something that, in fact, they didn't need to do under these oral arguments, because there are prima facie examples of the government literally paying Twitter and threatening, as I mentioned, antitrust against Facebook and others. But even if you remove that from the argument, the deeper philosophical point and economic point is that when you take somebody's money, even to put out a message that this other person's statement is dangerous and wrong, even if you're not engaging in legal action to stop that person, you're engaging in coercive force to take somebody's money to put out that message. As Thomas Jefferson said, that is immoral. The use of force to promote a message that runs counter to the morals of someone who's had his money taken is completely unjust and needs to be stood against. So the book publishers argued that the actions of the commission were an act of government censorship that failed to provide safeguards for protected speech. The state of Rhode Island. Oh, I thought it was in New York. Oh, yeah. OK. It was the publishing company was based in New York, but they were going up against the state of Rhode Island. That's what it was. State of Rhode Island argued that the commission lacked the power to suppress obscenity because its power was, quote, limited to informal sanctions. The state also argued that the actions of the commission were not actions of the state and as such did not fall within the scope of the 14th Amendment. The trial court agreed with the book publishers and granted the injunction against the commission, holding its actions unconstitutional. The Rhode Island Supreme Court, however, reversed the decision of the trial court, and the Supreme Court ended up agreeing with the publishers. As you can see on the screen, the U.S. Supreme Court voted 8-1 to reverse the decision of the Rhode Island Superior Court, but only six justices signed on to the majority opinion written by Justice William J. Brennan. And Hugo Black and Tom Clark concurred. In the majority's opinion, Justice Brennan addressed the arguments made by Rhode Island, writing that through its use of threats of prosecution, you got Joe Biden right there. But again, You don't even need those parallels. The commission engaged in actions that amounted to informal censorship. Look at Section 230. Always the threat hiding back there. And Alito was on top of that. Furthermore, these actions constituted acts of the state under the 14th Amendment because the commission operated under the color of state law. Brennan then addressed the arguments made by the book publishers and found them to have merit. He wrote that although the court's decision in a previous case in 1957 held that obscenity was not protected by the First Amendment, state regulations must contain certain procedural safeguards. These safeguards require, quote, that regulation by the states of obscenity conforms to procedures that will ensure against the curtailment of constitutionally protected expression. So in other words, these people were not afforded due process. Okay. And of course, if they were going to shut down these people and somehow that were seen as legal, that also would breach the Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments. Because you have the promise of due process, you have a trial by jury, and you can't punish someone and take stuff from someone without an actual trial. So that's what a taking is. So let's go back now with that background. You got that on that book decision. I'm going to go back. Here we go.
We'll hear argument first this morning in case 23411, Murphy versus Missouri. Mr. Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The government may not use coercive threats to suppress speech, but it is entitled to speak for itself by informing, persuading, or criticizing private speakers. Like Bantam Books, this case should be about that fundamental distinction between persuasion and coercion. But unlike Bantam and the case that you'll hear next, this is not a typical suit where a speaker challenges government actions affecting its own speech. Instead, two states and five individuals are trying to use the Article III courts to audit all of the executive branch's communications with and about social media platforms. That problem has infected every step of this case. Respondents don't have standing at all because they have not shown an imminent threat that the government will cause a platform to moderate their posts in particular. But the lower court still reviewed a vast range of speech by different officials to different platforms about different topics at different times without asking whether it had anything to do with respondents. And the courts then entered a universal injunction restricting speech about any content posted on any platform by anyone and binding thousands of officials, including presidential advisors speaking to the public and FBI agents trying to protect the nation from foreign threats.
Okay, let's stop it right there, everybody, because the protection from foreign threats thing, that goes into the Portman Murphy stuff. I've talked a lot about that. But one of the key things I want to discuss here is how he mentions that these people in particular don't have standing because they can't say that they personally were cited. And this is a very interesting, they're not going to get out of this. It's a very interesting philosophical reversal. Because in this case, they constantly tell us this canard of public health. So they remove the individual for the gestalt, for the consequentialist idea. And of course, the underlying threat is always one individual can be sacrificed for the greater so-called good, which, as I've mentioned, if you're in a logic class, means that everybody who comprises the so-called greater good is potentially a target. Therefore, it actually undermines the well-being or so-called general welfare of the greater good for all those people. Because every time you target someone, if you remove that person, there's going to be another person targeted in perpetuity. That's the way the state operates. Okay, so there's no such thing as general welfare. There's no such thing as public health because everybody actually is put in danger of having his rights destroyed for the so-called group, right? But what's curious here is Brian Fletcher, the principal deputy solicitor general, says that it must, that he tries to particularize it, right? He's trying to say, well, these people who are plaintiffs in particular, they can't claim that they were personally cited. It was a widespread non-citing of people where they came up with policies and algorithms and things like that, and they went after those things. Now, first of all, that's not true because literally the government had a backdoor on Facebook and on Twitter to remove specific, and they insisted, when are you going to get rid of this? When are you going to get rid of this over at Twitter? We saw Matt Taibbi's reporting on it. But even if that weren't the case, okay, what is really interesting logically and philosophically here is that the argument that they give about how the general will protect everybody is also now being used to say, you individual who were hurt, we must see particularization. And we don't see it on the government's argument side. You have to be a particular victim. And we're not seeing particularization here. It was only done to the general public. So literally what they're saying here is the exact opposite of what they argue for the so-called public health argument. They're saying, well, we were just threatening everybody. But now you see how there's never a connection for these people. They're always going to use some way to get out of this. So what they say here is it was only for the general people. There was never an individual cited, right? And so therefore, because there was no individual cited and it was only for the group, you have to be able to cite that individual who was hurt. But of course, they're saying we were threatening everybody. They're admitting they were threatening everybody. That's the point, right? If you didn't conform with that line, then you were part of that group. So that runs counter to their we're protecting the group argument. Now they're arguing, well, we were threatening the group. But the individual, again, is not part of the group. But it's insane. It's absolutely crazy. You see what I'm saying, right? It's totally stupid. You could draw it out on a logic tree on a board. It's absolutely insane. I don't know how this guy got through law school. It's amazing.
Even apart from the Article 3 problem, that injunction rests on two fundamental legal errors. First, the Fifth Circuit radically expanded the state action doctrine by holding that even concededly non-coercive communications, like the CDC's public health advice, can transform private platforms' editorial choices into state action. And second, the Fifth Circuit mistook persuasion for coercion. It held that the FBI's communications are inherently coercive because the FBI is a law enforcement agency, a theory that even respondents don't defend in this court. And it held that White House officials engaged in coercion because they used strong language or referred in a general way to legal reforms in response to press questions. If this court reaches the merits, it should reaffirm that government speech crosses the line into coercion only if, viewed objectively, it conveys a threat of adverse government action. And because...
Okay, so right there, what's the first thing that pops into your head if you have any, if you're at all cognizant of Section 230? The threat of public action. Because behind all of this is Section 230, which, as I mentioned in the video, promises online platforms and ISPs that they will be immune from state prosecution and from personal liability suits for defamation as long as the government, the federal government, deems that they are curating or moderating the content on their ISPs or their social media sites according to the good faith as defined by the feds. So that's always what I've been talking about this for a couple, like 3 years now. That's 4 years. That's always what was at the heart of this coercion, was that monster hiding behind the curtain. Guess what? We're going to let King Kong loose. We're going to let those chains off. He's going to go rampaging through New York City. If you don't do what we're telling you, we're going to have all those things removed because they decide. So this guy, he clearly doesn't understand what coercion and compulsion actually are. The threat was always there.
The threats happened here. The court should reverse. I welcome the court's questions.
Mr. Fletcher, is the coercion encouragement framework out of Bannum book the only way to look at this case?
Okay, so we're looking at that. That's Clarence Thomas, if you're just listening, is asking, is the coercion framework the only way to look at this case from the Bantam side of things?
So I think there are two ways to look at this case. I think one of them is the coercion inquiry, which we think comes from Bantam Books. You can think of that as an aspect of state action, because when private parties are compelled to act, as the court said in Halleck, they become state actors. We think that's the right way to think about this case.
What is actually the right way to think about this case if you're a constitutionalist? And again, I'm a voluntarist, so I would go a heck of a lot farther. First Amendment, strict wording. Congress shall make no law. States, different matter. And you're done. Let's continue.
Courts have also proposed a different way, the state action way. They've suggested that even absent coercion, the government speech, if it encourages, in some colloquial sense, private action, it can turn that private action into state action.
So I understand your argument, do we normally apply state action doctrine in cases involving the government or private parties?
Both, I think. In some state action cases, you're asking someone is suing a private party and alleging that that private party is bound by the contours of the First Amendment or other constitutional provisions because they're state actors. You see some suits like that that look like this, suits against the platforms, suits against Stanford University, which is referenced in its amicus brief here. But you also see suits against the government based on conduct by private parties. That was the case in Blum, and that's the theory that respondents are pursuing.
Are there any First Amendment cases?
Any First Amendment cases? I'm sorry.
Employing state action doctrine.
And suing the government. Off the top of my head, I can't think of one.
They're usually things like Medicare or government contracts or relationships like that.
Yeah, and I think what that gets at is that it's very unusual, and we don't think it's possible for the government through speech alone to transform private speakers into state actors. We think these cases usually are and ought to be viewed through the Bantam Books type framework, where there's a problem if the government is engaged in coercion, but if it stays on the persuasion side of the line and all we're talking about is government speech, then there's no state action and there's also no First Amendment problem.
One final question. You continue to refer to government speech. For my edification, what's the constitutional basis for government speech?
There you go. See, that is a key question. And it figures it would either be Alito or Thomas who would bring that up, right? Again, and it leads you towards the anarchist argument, because there is no ethical way that one can argue that government speech can be supported. It's just not, because it's all based on coercion. And of course, this idea of compulsion versus trying to convince people of something. The state has all compulsion powers under Section 230, because by removing the protection, that is it's offering a threat. So it's going to push people a certain way. And of course, we saw an overt statement by Biden to use antitrust against these guys. Let's continue.
The court has said, I think, that the government is entitled to speak for itself. It's not a right that comes from the First Amendment. It's a feature of our constitutional democracy. As the court has said, the government couldn't function if it couldn't express points of view. In Walker, the court explained, for example, that the government has to be able to run a vaccination campaign at times of public health crisis. I think that's a major part of what was going on here.
Shows you the complete unworkability of the state. Again, it's one of the reasons, just logically, functionally, it's impossible to run the state without stepping on somebody's toes. Just the way it is. It's axiomatic, right?
It hasn't located it in any specific constitutional provision. It's just part of democratic governance.
Explain to me what exactly
Brown, Jack. This might be Sotomayor. Sorry, I'm jumping the gun here.
Function doing? Meaning, how is it affecting your speech, the government's speech? And there's a lot of defense.
So she wants to know, how is the injunction affecting your speech? I'll go back just a second, because I stepped on her amazingly well-rehearsed and well-researched lines.
What exactly is the injunction doing? Meaning, how is it affecting your speech, the government's speech? And there's a lot of defendants.
Yep.
There's a lot of agencies. I know that our case law says an injunction just can't tell you to violate the law. And so this injunction might have that problem inherent in it. But the Fifth Circuit injunction is what's before us, correct?
Correct.
And it says to encourage or significantly to coerce. That's a legal term.
Yep.
Or significantly encourage. And you're questioning whether what the meaning of significant encouragement is. And I'm not sure I know exactly what the Fifth Circuit meant, but we can figure that out. to, let's just use, to coerce social media companies to remove, delete, suppress, or reduce, including through altering their algorithms, posted social media content containing protected speech. How is that harming the government? I want some specifics.
I'm happy to do that. And I'll say first, just to be clear, because this court has stayed the injunction, fortunately, it's not harming the government now. But there were times when we were getting... Exactly, right. So I think the problem with that, we don't say that the government can coerce private speakers. That is prohibited by the First Amendment. But the problem with the Fifth Circuit's injunction saying don't coerce or significantly encourage is that it comes at the end of 80 pages of legal analysis, holding that the government had done those things by, for example, when the FBI would send communications to the platforms saying, for your information, it is come to our attention that the following URLs or email addresses or other selectors are being used by malign foreign actors like Russian intelligence operatives to spread.
So right there, I wanted to make sure that I paused it right there because this is an excellent example of this guy, Brian Fletcher. And I saw some great comments over, I think Fregan was putting some, yeah, great comments over at Rumble. This guy, Brian Fletcher, is not just arguing to defend previous actions by the Biden administration or by members of the Trump administration that Trump just magically somehow couldn't control, right? The Fletcher statement here, starting to get into the Russia stuff, is to continue to promote the canard that there was some national security thing and that the Russian so-called interference or propaganda thing was a real thing. That it really was having an effect and was a national security issue, and that the feds had to inform these folks who ran their social media sites because it was just so extremely dangerous. Again, it's laughable. It's so obtuse and so ridiculous, but they're still pushing it. Even inside the halls of the Supreme Court, this guy knows that people are going to be looking at his words and he wants it on record. That's how dangerous these people are. He knows that even in the arguments, he can put in that little bit of a lie about that additional subject to reinforce his argument that it's important for national security, but also to perpetuate the falsehood that there was some national security issue. So he's got two prongs going. It's amazing. And you're going to see the same sort of thing from Ketanji Brown Jackson, right? And again, we know that they did threaten coercion. But the enticement part of it is always there with Section 230. And in a way, it's a form of coercion, because if they remove the so-called protections, then those online platforms can be sued for defamation if somebody using it hurts somebody else with some false statement, or for like pornography or something like that if a state wants to go after the social media platform or the ISP. We'll return with more Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live.
Eleutheromania, the insatiable desire for freedom. It's the new three-song heavy metal EP from Captain Kickass. Available now on your favorite music app or get it directly from CaptainKickass.com.
We return at Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. You can find Liberty Conspiracy live every Monday through Friday on Rockfin, Rumble, and my Twitter /X feed. That's at Gard Goldsmith, G-A-R-D Goldsmith. And please feel free to check out the Gardner Goldsmith Substack, where you'll find lots of news and information, the Sunday News Assembly with 20 stories pertaining to liberty, at least 20, plus video links, and of course, contextual information to help get to the roots of things. And I want to continue with our conversation looking into the oral arguments about the Murthy v. Missouri Supreme Court case. And in this case, we're investigating some of the context from decades ago about what might have been a precedent where the state of Rhode Island tried to stop certain books being published by Bantam Books within the state of Rhode Island. That was part of the discussion inside the Supreme Court. It's a minor part, but it is interesting and it is kind of important to check out before we get into some of the crazy statements from some of the Supreme Court justices and other statements that actually might comport a little bit more to their oaths to their constitution. We'll check it all out and look at deeper lessons of freedom right here on Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Thanks for listening, everyone. But the enticement part of it is always there with Section 230. And in a way, it's a form of coercion, because if they remove the so-called protections, then those online platforms can be sued for defamation if somebody using it hurts somebody else with some false statement, or for like pornography or something like that if a state wants to go after the social media platform or the ISP, right? Section 230 says if you conform to what the government says is okay, then you're going to have the carrot. Everything's okay. Well, hiding behind that is an even bigger monster of the existence of the FCC, which claims the power to do this. And hiding behind even that is the Constitution itself, which grants the Congress the power to be able to block certain types of lawsuits getting into federal courts going across state lines. So the anarchist argument becomes extremely strong here, because Section 230 actually has two facets of it. One is the government deciding what type of speech is okay and curated in good faith. And then the other is the capacity of the federal government to block interstate lawsuits inside the federal courts. So let's say hypothetically you only had a social media website that only operated in your state, right? If there were a lawsuit on that, unless there was some challenge that, you know, the case didn't go properly and they were going to, you know, appeal that to the federal level on, you know, 14th Amendment grounds or something like that, or 5th or 6th or 8th Amendment grounds, that would just be pertain to the states. There would be no cross state lawsuit. Like we mentioned, you know, when they had the rightful use and carry of firearms act that they put forward, you know, what was it, 15, 20 years ago or something like that. The lawful use of firearms act, which prevented litigation, tortious claims against gun makers if somebody used a gun, it worked properly, but that they used it to kill somebody. You know, it didn't malfunction, right? Well, the Congress said, no, that's a frivolous lawsuit. We're not even going to allow those interstate. But if you were inside a state and the gun maker were in that state, you could still sue, because it's not interstate, it's intrastate. So that's the difference between the federal court system and the circuit, you know, the federal district courts, federal appellate courts and stuff like that. Anything above a state Supreme Court and below the federal Supreme Court, the federal government can create the court system and then decide what cases can go into that court system. So in this case, under Section 230, they were preventing suits against the multi-state use ISPs or social media sites that were going in all these different states from one state to another. They were going to prevent those types of things for defamation and the states bringing some sort of action against the people who ran it. So they have that capacity, and that's actually an enticement and a threat at the same time. And so this is the problem that we see here, because the Biden administration, even if you weren't concentrating on the fact that the Biden administration, Joe Biden himself, vocally said he would use antitrust against these companies if they didn't start to remove content that the government said was dangerous, whether it's about Russia or COVID or the jabs or whatever, right? Now it's going to be about, you know, Israel or whatever it might be, right? And they want to continue to do it despite this injunction. The thing that's hiding behind all that is two-pronged: the FCC, which is unconstitutional, and that Section 230 first half, which gives legal immunity if you go by the government's game. And this is where the threat lies. We're going to remove your protection. That's a threat, right? So we'll continue. Here we go. Here's more from wonderful Mr. Fletcher.
The platforms saying, for your information, it has come to our attention.
I went back a little bit, by the way. I'm going to go back just a little bit more here. Here we go.
For example, when the FBI would send communications to the platforms saying, for your information, it has come to our attention that the following URLs or email addresses or other selectors are being used by malign foreign actors like Russian intelligence operatives to spread disinformation on your platforms. Do with it what you will. That the Fifth Circuit held is coercive because the FBI is a powerful law enforcement agency. And I think if the injunction were put in place, the FBI would have to think very hard about whether it could continue to do that. Similarly, I think both the Fifth Circuit and my friends have really said that the crux of what they claim was coercion here was what happened in July of 2021 when the Surgeon General, the White House press secretary, and the president himself made statements criticizing the platform's practices on misinformation and false statements about COVID vaccines and calling on them to do better. I think it's really troubling, the idea that those sorts of classic bully pulpit exhortations, public statements urging actors to behave in different ways, might be deemed to violate the First Amendment. And I think if
So again, he is fudging the historical record. It wasn't, we exhort you to do better. It was, we plead for you to do better or else. That's what it was. That's what it was. There's no denying this. And there's the added corruption that they were literally funding this, not only by giving Twitter $3.5 million, but also through the Portman Murphy so-called Countering Foreign Propaganda Act with things like NewsGuard. You're talking to a guy who worked for hours trying to answer NewsGuard emails. This case pertains to me and probably you if you're trying to post some truth about the so-called pandemic. It's amazing. People's lives were harmed or lost because of the actions of these state operators. They are offensive, absolutely, utterly, historically dark, totally evil.
Injunction were to go into effect and the president or his senior advisors, the president isn't enjoined, but if his senior advisors, the press secretary or someone else, wanted to talk to the public about other problems like the circulation of anti-Semitic or Islamophobic content on social media platforms, or the effects they might be having on children's mental health, or national security issues like the anti-Semitic Osama bin Laden letter that was trending on TikTok at the end.
There you go. He's going right into it. It's all propagandistic. Was the Osama bin Laden letter anti-Semitic or anti-Western and Zionist aggression? I think we know. I think it's very clear. And of course, it's amazing. He's involved with propagating falsehoods even while he's there, not just to defend the past, but to promote things today, now, in the current argumentation. It's just mind-blowing. I couldn't believe it while I was sitting there. I was having some carrots at lunch. I'm like, holy smoke. Wow.
Last year, we referenced towards the end of our brief. I think all of those things could be done only under the shadow of the injunction. And that comes around to the other point that you made, which is that this injunction, especially read in light of the opinion that comes before it, is extremely vague. And I think.
Okay, so get this. This guy is arguing. This guy is arguing those very, very important messages that they'd like to get out can only be done now under the threat of this injunction. Well, what were they doing to us? What were they doing to the ISPs and the social media or social media companies, except putting out a threat that if you don't conform to a particular order or message, it's an implied order, you're going to get slammed. He's making the same argument for the government that actually could apply to us under all these standards that they were pushing. This fatuous dude named Fletcher literally is complaining because the government might be prevented from putting out its message. It's like, dude, do you have any concept of what a massive hypocrite you look like? I mean, this is like I mentioned, this is like not Mount Olympus. This is Olympus Mons on Mars, that big a mountain of hypocrisy. It's incredible. Unbelievable. I wonder how much this dude gets paid.
Having that sort of vague injunction with these contestable legal terms that have been interpreted very broadly as applied to past conduct, hanging over the heads of all of these government officials doing all of these things, is a real problem. And I think especially so when you're talking about entering such an injunction at the behest of two states and five individual social media users whose main complaints are about the moderation of posts about COVID-19 many years ago that they haven't really even shown were traceable to the government to begin with, we think. And we certainly don't think that they've shown that they face the sort of imminent threat of future injury that's required to satisfy Article 3.
Mr. Fletcher, let me follow up on that. If even one of the plaintiffs has standing, then we're required to get to the merits. So let me ask you about Ms. Hines. And as you just mentioned, she must have faced an imminent threat of future injury at the time when the complaint was filed. And that injury must be traceable to the actions of the government. So in the first part of that, imminent threat of future injury, her Facebook personal account was restricted at the time when the complaint was filed. So why isn't that sufficient to show a threat of an imminent threat of future injury?
We're not disputing that when the private platforms moderated the plaintiff's pages or their posts, that's an injury in some sense. We haven't disputed that they suffered that injury. We've disputed the traceability question and then the redressability question.
Right. So on traceability is basically a question of causation, right?
Agreed.
All right. Both the district court found that the injury was traceable to the government's actions, and the Fifth Circuit accepted that finding, reviewed it, and accepted it. So that's two lower courts. We don't usually reverse findings of fact that have been endorsed by two lower courts, and you haven't attempted to show that it was clear that that finding is clearly erroneous.
So respectfully, Justice Alito, I disagree with that. I think that the Fifth Circuit and the district court applied too loose a notion of traceability. They didn't try to say this post or any post or any action against Ms. Hines was traceable to any action by the government. They did what the red brief calls a bird's eye view of traceability. They said the government is talking to the platforms a lot. The platforms are doing moderation. And so we'll just assume that all of that moderation is traceable to the government.
Well, do you think that...
All right. So I just want to pause it there, because anybody who understands the way that the platforms operate understands that the operation is based on algorithms that they create, which will then target particular types of speech. So if she has a type of speech that matches certain types of speech that the government told these platforms was dangerous types of speech, and it's traceable, of course, to the threat that they'll remove Section 230 protection, you've got traceability right there. And it's just ridiculous. So this guy's arguing, again, as I mentioned, because it's done to a lot of people, you can't trace it to a specific person. But the policy of doing it to a lot of people then hoovers up her specific post because it has a content in it that they designed to go after that specific wording, those things, those keywords. The specificity is inherent in the AI programming. That's the point. It could be anybody. This is what they don't get. They don't understand. When they generalize these things, it's a generalization that hits individuals, period. They don't get it. Amazing. Alito nails this. This is excellent.
It's necessary to identify a single government action and then trace it to a single consequence. Do you think that's required?
No, but I think you have to trace some government action to some consequence that befell you. And maybe I could just be specific about this, because we challenged this in our opening brief, and the red brief comes back at pages 19 to 21 and offers up what I take to be their best examples of traceable harm. And I invite you to go look at the pages of the record that they're citing, because often what you find is that they're citing moderation of their content that happened either before the challenged government actions to which they're referring or long after.
All right, I have looked at that. On the issue of causation, under Malhealthy, are they required to show anything more than the government's action was a motivating factor?
I don't know the answer to that in all cases, and I'm reluctant to make sort of broad statements about what the traceability requirement demands in different circumstances. I will say here, we're not disputing that. We're saying that they haven't shown any causal connection between the...
It has no effect whatsoever.
Right. And
both the lower courts were wrong on that.
I think they were, because, again, they did this blunderbuss approach where they said the government is talking to the platforms about moderation and the platforms are moderating content. But the platforms were moderating this content long before the government was talking to them. They had powerful business incentives to do the same thing. The acts of moderation...
Okay, again, it's just so important. So important. Why do you think, as we all know, why were the platforms moderating that content? Twofold, philosophically, and also because they knew the threat of Section 230 was there and that if they stepped out of bounds, they'd be in trouble. It's very, very clear. We knew this from the start as they started to promote these lines. Suddenly, we started to see, as the government started to push these lines, so followed social media. The government came up with these lines first. The CDC argued these things. Fauci argued these things. And then the social media sites followed after that. They didn't come up with this on their own. They didn't hire scientists to say, oh, let's look into this information. No, they went with what was the so-called science.
Consistent with the platform's own policies. And this is, I think, another telling fact. In those red brief examples that we talked about on pages 19 to 21, some of them involve platforms like LinkedIn that wasn't even the subject of the challenged White House and Surgeon General's office communications with the platforms.
Do you think that there are any factual findings with respect to standing that we are required to give clear error review to?
I think findings of historical fact.
That was Elena Kagan, by the way, if you're just listening.
We're not fighting that. So the idea that pieces of content were moderated, that the government made certain statements. And if there had been findings that said Facebook deleted this post because of these communications by the government, that would be a factual finding, a historical fact. But there just aren't such findings.
Right. I mean, that's what I was really getting at. Are there findings that you concede, you know, that one, you have to apply clear error if you do. That one, you have to do the same.
Yeah, we do. And I can't give you a list because there's a lot of facts in this case. But we agree historical factual findings count. What we say don't count are findings that are really characterizations, which is a lot of what my friends are relying on. Findings that are about the application of law to facts, which in this constitutional realm, we think get de novo review. And then findings that are premised on erroneous legal standards.
So, Mr. Fletcher, I just want to nail down what your views are on the legal standards, on traceability.
This is Neil Gorsuch speaking, if you're just listening. Now he's talking about traceability here.
You're not disputing that a motivating factor is enough.
We haven't made that argument here. That's right.
Okay. And then on redressability, what's your view of the legal standard the court should be applying?
I think, again, it has to be some showing that I think likely to redress the injury is the standard from Lujan. So it doesn't have to be certain, but you have to make some showing that an injunction against the government will stop the platforms from doing
it. In Massachusetts versus EPA, we've said likely to some extent. Does that strike you as correct?
I think in the context of Mass versus EPA, maybe where you're talking about a problem of degrees, you know, here where the concern is, are the platforms going to moderate my posts or not? And are they going to do it because of the government or not? And will an injunction against the government stop Facebook? And
to some degree, is that an acceptable standard to the government?
I guess I just
want to know what my yardstick that I'm supposed to measure these allegations against. And there's not a lot in your brief about it. So I take lightly from Lujan.
Yeah.
I take to some extent from Massachusetts versus EPA, and I take the statement in Larson that it doesn't have to redress every injury.
Agreed.
You agreed with all of that?
Except that to some extent, I think, was there the state's injury was about rising sea levels, and so to some extent means it doesn't have to solve the problem. It has to help it a little bit.
And you
this
agree,
is more discrete acts of content.
Do you agree operation. With that standard, though, that to some extent, if they could show that their injury would be remedied to some extent by an injunction, that would be enough.
Correct. So if they're likely to face moderation on 10 posts and an injunction against the government would make it 8, that's enough.
Yeah. Okay. And then just flipping back to traceability, I'm sorry, I forgot to ask. Substantial motivating factor obviously means it doesn't have to be proximate cause.
Agreed.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Fletcher, when I read all of the emails exchanged between the White House and other federal officials and Facebook in particular, but also some of the other platforms.
This is Sam Alito.
And I see that the White House and federal officials are repeatedly saying that Facebook and the federal government should be partners. We are on the same team. Officials are demanding answers. I want an answer. I want it right away. When they're unhappy, they curse them out. There are regular meetings. There is constant pestering of Facebook and some of the other platforms, and they want to have regular meetings. And they suggest, why don't you, they suggest rules that should be applied, and why don't you tell us everything that you're going to do so we can help you and we can look it over. And I thought, wow, I cannot imagine federal officials taking that approach to the print media, our representatives over there. If you did that to them, what do you think the reaction would be? And so I thought, you know, the only reason why this is taking place is because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it, and so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like they're subordinates.
Would you do that?
Exactly. And it just it's stunning to me that anybody who is at all cognizant doesn't go directly to Section 230 and the antitrust threat, period. They're always behind the whole thing. And you know, it's amazing. So I would love to ask Mr. Fletcher and say, OK, it's not exactly analogous, but if you worked for a company that got bought out and then the heads of the company said, well, you know, under the old leadership, we had sort of a promise that, you know, you could get, oh, I don't know, a 2-hour lunch, or, you know, you could keep your job if you continue to do X, Y, or Z. But we're going to change that policy if you don't do this new thing now. Now, people will look at that and say, well, that's a breach of contract. You're messing with me. I had an agreement with these other people, and you're supposed to abide by that agreement, right? Well, under the Constitution, which they foist on us, we didn't even agree to that. It's very clear what's going on. And under Section 230 of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and even under the unconstitutional antitrust statutes, these guys are preventing threats. And those threats are having an effect overall on the population, on the overall universe of different social media sites, of the populations there. Inside those universes, they are populated by specific individuals. So if these sites are coming up with universal policies that are they're applying through algorithms, it's clearly traceable to any individual who might use that and be seeing something that says, oh, that terminology just had me removed. Very easily, somebody had to remove them, and it was for that language. That, again, is, I think, the deeper approach than even just citing Joe Biden threatening antitrust. But Alito nails it because he mentions Section 230. That is exactly right. And I think anybody who goes to law school, if they're not familiar with this and they're talking about telecommunications, for goodness sake, it's stunning to me. If I had been sitting there on the benches listening to this, I would have gotten up and freaked out. It's insane.
To the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press.
Yeah, yeah. So
or
this is a great
any
point.
Other big news.
Let's just go back. He's like, if they had said this to a newspaper, would anybody have accepted that? Not a chance, right?
Because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's, to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like their subordinates.
We'll return with more Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live, continuing our investigation into the oral arguments in the Murthy v. Missouri free speech case. Find us every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. live on Rockfin, Rumble, and my Twitter/X at Guard Goldsmith.
Free Talk Live.
We're back with more Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live, continuing our investigation into the Murthy v. Missouri Supreme Court case, going in-depth into the oral arguments on Monday and picking apart the positives and the very dangerous negatives.
Mr. Fletcher, when I read all of the emails exchanged between the White House and other federal officials and Facebook in particular, but also some of the other platforms.
This is Sam Alito.
And I see that the White House and federal officials are repeatedly saying that Facebook and the federal government should be partners. We are on the same team. Officials are demanding answers. I want an answer. I want it right away. When they're unhappy, they curse them out. There are regular meetings. There is constant pestering of Facebook and some of the other platforms, and they want to have regular meetings. And they suggest, why don't you, they suggest rules that should be applied, and why don't you tell us everything that you're going to do so we can help you and we can look it over. And I thought, wow, I cannot imagine federal officials taking that approach to the print media, yeah, our representatives over there. If you did that to them, what do you think the reaction would be? And so I thought, you know, the only reason why this is taking place is because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's, to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like they're subordinates. Would you do that?
Exactly. And it's stunning to me that anybody who is at all cognizant doesn't go directly to Section 230 and the antitrust threat. Period. They're always behind the whole thing. And you know, it's amazing. So I would love to ask Mr. Fletcher and say, okay, it's not exactly analogous, but if you worked for a company that got bought out and then the heads of the company said, well, you know, under the old leadership, we had sort of a promise that, you know, you could get, a 2-hour lunch, or, you know, you could keep your job if you continue to do X, Y, or Z. But we're going to change that policy if you don't do this new thing now. Now, people will look at that and say, well, that's a breach of contract. You're messing with me. I had an agreement with these other people, and you're supposed to abide by that agreement, right? Well, under the Constitution, which they foisted on us, we didn't even agree to that. It's very clear what's going on. And under Section 230 of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and even under the unconstitutional antitrust statutes, these guys are preventing threats. And those threats are having an effect overall on the population, on the overall universe of different social media sites, of the populations there. Inside those universes, they are populated by specific individuals. So if these sites are coming up with universal policies that they're applying through algorithms, it's clearly traceable to any individual who might use that and be seeing something that says, oh, that terminology just had me removed. Very easily, somebody had to remove them, and it was for that language. That, again, is, I think, the deeper approach than even just citing Joe Biden threatening antitrust. But Alito nails it because he mentions Section 230. That is exactly right. And I think anybody who goes to law school, if they're not familiar with this and they're talking about telecommunications, for goodness sake, it's stunning to me. If I had been sitting there on the benches listening to this, I would have gotten up and freaked out. It's insane.
To the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press.
Yeah, yeah. So
or
this is a great
any
point.
Other big news.
Let's go back. He's like, if they had said this to a newspaper, would anybody have accepted that? Not a chance, right?
Because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's, to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like they're subordinates. Would you do that to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press or any other big newspaper or wire service?
So there's a lot packed in there. I want to give you one very specific answer first and then step back out to the broader context. So specifically, you mentioned demanding an answer right away and cursing them out. The only time that happens is in an email that's about the president's own Instagram account. It's not about moderating other people's
content. Okay, we'll put that aside. There's all the rest. Constant meetings, constant emails. We want answers. Right. We're partners. We're on the same team. You think that the print media regards themselves as being on the same team as the federal government, partners with the federal government?
So potentially in the context of an effort to get Americans vaccinated during a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. And
so
I really
it's
think
an exception.
That piece of context.
So if you've got your boss and they're like, hey, we're on the same team, this new boss comes in, when they're telling you to do something you never did before, it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Again, the compelling state interest argument is underlying that. States don't have an interest. Again, it's just a rephrasing of the public health thing, the general welfare thing. There's no such thing as state interest. States aren't people. The only way states exist is by undercutting the individual interest and choices of individuals to make decisions for their own stinking lives. This is the philosophical battle we fight every day against the state.
Doesn't change the First Amendment principles, but it's relevant to how they apply here. And I think it's important to understand that at this time, this was a time when thousands of Americans were still dying every week, and there was a hope that getting everyone vaccinated could stop the pandemic. And there was a concern that Americans were getting their news about the vaccine from these platforms, and the platforms were promoting, not just posting, but promoting bad information.
So let's just argue here real quick. Let's just pull out the logic again. What if somebody were to say, hey, can I pause you there, Mr. Fletcher? You know, Mr. Fletcher, it's interesting. Here we are in the halls of government. I'd like to challenge you on your claims about the thousands of people dying every day from this virus. Can I do that now, or is it not allowed? Can we debate this here? Can we debate this in these halls of the government, or am I going to get in trouble? Is something going to happen to me? I tell you what, let's not do it here. Let's do it in social media. We can have it out. It'd be great. We can have a debate. Oh, no, that's right. You'll use government to threaten the online people so I can't speak. Oh, interesting, Mr. Fletcher. So the very debate that we're undergoing here, you're presenting information that should be questioned but can't be questioned. Maybe we shouldn't have debates inside courts at all. Maybe that, too, should be verboten if we liken it to social media. Is that right? It's only what's allowed in the government. Is that right? Is that how we're going to do it? We have a certain period of time for oral arguments and we're done, and we only allow certain people in. Is that the way it works? I get it. That's awesome. That is great. Rounding this off. Here we go.
Madam, I know the objectives were good, but once again, they were also getting their news from the print media and the broadcast media and cable media. And I just can't imagine the federal government doing that to them. But maybe I'm naive. Maybe that goes on behind the scenes. I don't, but I it struck me as, wow, this is not what I understand the relationship to be. That's all.
I think this is important because I have the same reaction that you do, that these emails look unusual. I think the idea that there'd be back and forth between the government and the media isn't unusual at all. When the White House press secretary on July 16th is asked about this by the press at the time, what she says is, of course, we talk to the platforms just the way we talk to all of you when we have concerns about what you're doing, when we have information that you might find helpful. Now, there's an intensity of the back and forth here, and there's an anger that I think is unusual. But the context for that, I think, is that these platforms were saying publicly, we want to help. We think we have a responsibility to give people accurate information and not bad information. And we're doing.
So again, there he is trying to blur the lines and ask the question, where do you draw the line? You have to allow communication between the government and the public, and you have to allow for back and forth. So sometimes it might get heated. They might disagree. Where do you draw the line? You know where you draw the line, Mr. Fletcher? From taking my neighbor's money to fund it. How about that? This is, again, this always trends towards the complications that anarchists, voluntarists try to bring up about the dysfunctionality of the state. You can't allow it to function properly because everybody argues over how it should be functioned and everybody has their stuff taken to pay for it. So even the so-called back and forth that this guy tries to depict as perfectly acceptable, that this was just part of the back and forth that we typically see in government. It wasn't anything more than that. Well, that's offensive on his face because he's lying, right? But in addition to that, that starts to get you into the infinite regress of where do you draw the line as to what is the government just putting out so-called basic functions of government? Because everybody who pays money into the government, they might have different opinions about what is an okay function. Is it 10 pieces of messages a day from the government or one or two? Is it about when they're going to have the Easter egg roll or is it about something else? What if it's just you can't decide in the gestalt? Because not everybody is going to agree. And this is where we continue to see these people blurring the lines because they're trying to play on people's differing opinions and say, well, this was acceptable, just like all the other stuff that is just basic government functioning. But the basic government functioning itself presents debates. That's the problem. It's always the problem.
Everything we can to meet that goal. That's where this language of partnership comes from. It's not just from the White House. It's these platforms, which are powerful, sophisticated entities, saying we're doing the best we can. And the anger, I think really most of the anger when you read the emails, and I appreciate that you have, because I think you have to look at them in context. The anger is when the officials think that the platforms are not being transparent about the scope of the problem or aren't giving information that's available.
Well, let me ask you one more question, and then I'll stop, at least for now. You make a big point in both your brief and your reply that states don't have First Amendment rights. But are you saying that they may have a free speech right, but it comes from someplace else, or they don't have free speech rights? Do you think that the federal government could prohibit a governor or the top-ranking public health official in a state from speaking to the residents?
No, I don't think it could. And I want to be clear, we're not denying that they have speech rights. We're saying that those things, like the federal government's speech rights, come from the structure of our Constitution, not from the First Amendment. This is a First Amendment case, and I think really what's happening here is that these states, which were the motivating factor behind the suit, the only plaintiffs in the initial complaint, are really trying to represent and to litigate the First Amendment rights of their citizens on their citizens' behalf. We think that's an end run around the limit on parents patriae standing, just like the one the court rejected.
Do you think, on the anger point, I guess I'd assumed, thought, experienced government press people throughout the federal government who regularly call up the media and berate them. Is that not?
I don't
understanding. You said the anger here was unusual. I guess I wasn't. Entirely clear on that from my own experience.
That's fair. I guess I don't want to endorse berate, but I guess I will say I bet this is not the first time that there's been profanity or intemperate language in exchanges between White House or agency communication staff and members of the press.
Well, I don't know whether our public information officer is here today, but maybe she should take a note about this. So whenever they write something that we don't like, she can call them up and curse them out and say, why don't we be partners? We're on the same team. Why don't you show us what you're going to write beforehand? We'll edit it for you, make sure it's accurate.
So, Justice Alito, this is why I want to be careful here. I'm acknowledging the reality that this happens and that it may be commonplace. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a great thing or a thing to be celebrated, but fundamentally I'm saying the First Amendment isn't a civility code. It is an important protection. It's a critical protection against actual coercion, but I think it's important to police that line, and I think this case, the sort of sprawling audit of all of these communications, shows the danger of allowing parties, especially parties without real direct injuries, to come into court and to challenge these sorts of regular back and forths.
On the partner's point, though, that does strike me as unusual. I mean, what do you think about that?
So that, I think, is traceable to the unusual feature here of this is not the government where the platforms were saying, we don't want to deal with you about this. And the government is calling them up and saying, no, we're partners. Let's be partners. You could imagine a situation like that where there might be a problem. You might start to think that starts to shade into coercion. But here it's an open door. The platform are saying publicly, because they're getting public criticism about this from other people too, from the press, from the World Health Organization, from others, they're saying publicly, we want to do our part. We recognize we have a responsibility, that we're a source of information for people, and we want to be a source of good information. And so when the White House calls and says we have some concerns about this, they say, we agree. You know, that's a good point you make over here.
Again, the point was they were doing it because they knew the threat was there. They knew. They didn't just step forward themselves proactively and say, oh, we're going to do this and do that, and we're going to have scientific teams and things like that. It's ridiculous. And again, if this guy's so upset that this small group of people bringing their suit and asking for an injunction might prevent the government from saying what it wants to say in an anthropomorphic sense, well, then what's he saying? He's actually arguing in favor of free speech, right? Except, of course, it has to be the speech of the state. The state is emblematic. It represents truth. It has to function for the so-called public good. But what's the public good? The individuals. So the individuals can be silenced for the individuals? Oh, that's right. There's no such thing as the public because it's just a large number of individuals, and the individuals never lose their rights. And if you threaten the individuals for the sake of the larger group, then everybody in the group can be threatened, and you undercut your rationale already.
Disagree with you over here. We're not going to go this far, but we agree with you.
And Mr. Fletcher, whether or not that ultimately becomes a First Amendment violation, I mean, I appreciate the coercion point, and that's sort of the government's first.
Okay, now this is Ketanji Brown Jackson. Listen very carefully when she's like, well, I appreciate the coercion point and see where this leads. This is interesting, very interesting.
Coercion point, and that's sort of the government's first point with respect to the merits of this. But I'm interested in your view that the context doesn't, quote, change the First Amendment principles. I mean, I understood our First Amendment jurisprudence to require heightened scrutiny of government restrictions of speech, but not.
Okay, so she's already laying in a canard. Heightened scrutiny of government restrictions of speech. Not actually the wording of the Constitution. You know, it's very easy to understand. It's the First Amendment. You can read it. You don't have to read interpretations or make one up on the spot while you're talking with this guy. You don't have to say, well, I understand that the government allows for a bunch of wiggle room. No, it doesn't. The federal government is prohibited. Congress shall make no law. Let's go back to Ms. Ketanji Brown Jackson, as she puts forward this, of course, postmodernist view of, well, we can just make it up. Here we go.
The government's first point with respect to the merits of this. But I'm interested in your view that the context doesn't, quote, change the First Amendment principles. I mean, I understood our First Amendment jurisprudence to require heightened scrutiny of government restrictions of speech, but not necessarily a total prohibition when you're talking about a compelling interest of the government to ensure.
There you go. See? So again, the First Amendment doesn't mean what it says. There are exceptions. And it comes up to the government coming up with a compelling state interest. So that therefore means that the First Amendment doesn't matter at all. Because the government will define what is a compelling government interest. And it's just ridiculous. It's so stupid. Anybody who's got any brains can sit there and say, so let me see. You've got a prohibition in the document you swore to uphold that says Congress shall make no law. The federal government, Congress, they're not supposed to get involved here. You have no capacity to do this. Now you're saying the standard is not that, it's the compelling state interest. Oh, well, then that's fine. And let me just ask, who defines what the compelling state interest is? Oh, the government. Oh, the state. I see. So there is no end at all. It can do whatever it wants to anytime and just define it that way. I see, Ketanji Brown Jackson. Thanks so much. So she's putting that forward already to lay the groundwork that doesn't even need to be laid here. Okay. She's putting forward an even larger postmodernist concept that the First Amendment is completely meaningless. And it's all just debate about picayune things and the definition of compelling state interest. And of course, it's an emergency, right? Of course.
Or, for example, that the public has accurate information in the context of a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. So I'm just interested in the government sort of conceding that if there was coercion, then we automatically have a First Amendment violation. So I'm not conceding.
So there you go, right? Well, coercion is perfectly acceptable then. It's amazing. So she's going beyond this. She's not even arguing whether there was coercion or not coercion. She's saying coercion is justified. And it gets worse. I'll play even more. It gets worse. Glenn Greenwald noticed this. A bunch of people noticed this. This woman is really dangerous. Really dangerous for free speech. This is one of the most compelling and consequential cases in my lifetime. This is massive. And there's a bunch of very dangerous people in the court and in the government.
That would be the case. I could imagine that in times of pandemic, if there were actual restrictions, maybe those would be justified. But our position here, because we think it's the position consistent with the facts, is that there wasn't any coercion to begin with.
Mr. Fletcher, on that point, you mentioned coercion.
This is great. Here we go. Here we go.
Repeatedly, and in terms of threats, can there also be coercion, in your view, in terms of inducements?
We think there can. I think often a threat or an inducement is sort of the flip side, one or the other. I think in the next case, you could construe it either way, threat of prosecution, offer of leniency. So we acknowledge that it could be both, but it has to be a threat or an inducement of some concrete government action, not just a more government speech.
And hypothetically, and I'm not saying this happened here, but would a threat or an inducement with respect to any trust actions qualify as coercion?
Sure.
And a threat or an inducement with respect to Section 230 qualify?
So I think that one's harder for two reasons. One is that these are executive branch officials who don't have the ability to unilaterally enact 230 reform. I think the question is...
They have a power to influence that.
Influence that, but the question is...
Would that be enough to say we're going to, if you don't do X, we are going to change our position on
Section 230. So potentially yes as to legislation. 230, if I could just get this out, though, I think is different, because 230 is about content moderation. It's about this very issue. And I think a government official has to be able to say, I support Section 230 reform because I'm concerned about these things. And also, in the meantime, I think platforms should be doing better.
I understand that.
All right. So we'll pause it right there. I want to get your opinions now. We've done a really, really good section here. But I love the way the guy dodges. He dodges and weaves. It's just amazing. He's like, well, I think we need Section 230 reform. You're not addressing the point, dude. As it stands, Section 230 can be removed. It's therefore a reverse threat. It's in a way, it's a threat because they will remove the incentives and it'll get nailed through defamation suits. And of course, he mentioned the antitrust as well. That was Neil Gorsuch, if you're just listening in audio. And to be redundant, if you're just listening. So you're in a moot court. This would just be such an easy slam dunk. And the problem is that, as I said, if they were explicit about this, then they would question Section 230. They would question the FCC. They would question antitrust, all the things that were used as the carrots and sticks to threaten these people. They're not going to go that far, clearly. They won't even question Section 230. There's a lot more Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live coming up.
Free Talk Live.
We return with Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. Find Liberty Conspiracy every Monday through Friday at Rumble, Rockfin, and my Twitter /X feed at Guard Goldsmith. And, of course, I invite you anytime to subscribe free over at my Substack. And remember, every Sunday you'll find at least 20 news stories plus video links pertaining to freedom. And I get to add contextual information that hopefully will help break apart those news stories and let us derive intellectual ammunition to take with us for future situations that are similar. Let's continue with Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live. I want to show you the latest manifestation of this. I think you'll find it pretty darn interesting. It's about the squatters. Yes, and that's not like a new weird punk band or something like that. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Bristol. We are the squatters. No, I don't think so. Although that is how Killing Jokes and The Clash and Motorhead started. They all squatted in the same building in Ladbroke Grove, just outside of London. And it was Joe Strummer who got the electrics working for them. Absolutely amazing. Here it is, everybody. This is the latest in that Queen squatter story. And again, I'm not talking Freddie Mercury coming back from the grave and coming in to sing inside your living room and you don't want him there. You know, nothing like that. Although, who wouldn't want him there? Well, some people wouldn't. So here it is. The Queen's squatters flee $1 million home after standoff with homeowner and visit from vigilantes. And some of those were armed, from what I've heard. All right, here it is. Check it out. And by the way, you want to see the handyman? The handyman on this stuff. You got to see this. This is quite interesting. Let me go to this. I think you'll find it kind of fun. All right, here we go. Here's the handyman delivering the state of squatting in 2023.
It's almost like, I found a loophole. I can live rent free. And, you know, unfortunately, people are losing their homes over it. They're taking everything from these homeowners. Hi, my name is Flash Shelton. I'm the founder of the United Handyman Association, and I help people remove their squatters. The thing that I think summarized the most from 2023 is that a lot of people in this country are they might have an issue with something, and they might talk about it, and they might vent about it, and they might go on social media about it. But when it comes to actually doing something, I don't know if people are afraid to put themselves out there or afraid to put their name on something. You know, our country is so upside down in so many ways, not just squatter issues. There are a lot of issues that we need to deal with, and I don't think we're.
All right, so we'll stop it there because we have an ad for ThriftBooks coming up, of course, which I frequent very often. So there you go. So let me get into the story. But just to let you know, part of the reason I thought that video was interesting was because one of the problems, and David Knight brought this up on his show today, and you can watch David Knight every Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. Eastern time to noon time, and find out about David Knight by going to thedavidknightshow.com. You can check him out. His channel is on Rumble. It's growing by leaps and bounds. You can also check out the Rockfin channel and follow him as Libertarian, at Libertarian on X. But one of the things is that the bureaucracies in places like Queens are so slow to respond that by the time they get to a place to try to investigate the squatters have been there long enough that they actually can claim legal amnesty and stay there. It's absolutely nuts. So let's get to this one. Here it is. Two of the three squatters who allegedly took over a woman's $1 million home in Queens fled the property after recently having a tense standoff with the property's owner and facing vigilantes, in quotes, if you're just listening, who tried to evict the illegal tenants, a new report finds. Adele Andaloro, 47, said her property in Flushing, Queens, had been taken over by a group of squatters while the woman tried to sell the property last month. The home had been owned by Andaloro's parents, who had left her house when they died. And you probably have seen the video of that dude from Venezuela speaking in a foreign tongue, of course, talking about how he knows how to do it. He can tell everybody how to do it. He's helped a lot of people do it. And he thinks that they have a right to take people's property, to squat in their lives. This week, the Daily Mail reported that a pair of vigilantes had visited the home to confront the squatters and try to get them off the property. Quote, "We are looking to get this guy out," one of the men who was wearing a pro-Trump T-shirt told during the ordeal, told the Daily Mail of why they were there. "I'm here to talk to him. I want to see why he is here." Okay. The squatters did not leave immediately after the two men appeared on the doorstep demanding answers, but two of the allegedly illegal tenants fled the property the next day, the Daily Mail reported. So just in the past 12 hours, folks, I know the world is focused on it, but it is a big deal for this woman, and it is a big deal for principle and, of course, the dysfunctional nature of the state. And then we've got the other things, which is, when was the last time your move was subsidized by the government? We'll talk about squatting in many other ways in just a minute. But two of the allegedly illegal tenants fled the property the next day, the Daily Mail reported. Two of the alleged squatters were seen jumping into a car while shielding their faces from cameras and refusing to answer any questions, the outlet reported. It's unclear whether they left for good. Fox News Digital tried to reach Andaloro Thursday morning for any updates on the case. Another squatter said he lives there legally and will leave after he gets a deposit back. Quote, "I have no idea what is going on here with this nonsense. I'm trying to get my money back and just get out of here. I have nothing to do with this," the man identified as Kevin Baletzi said. "I have receipts saying I paid the landlord and the real estate. Other than that, I am no part of it," he continued to comment. "I wash my hands of this. I am gone." Well, not really. Last month, the homeowner had a tense standoff with the reported squatters after she had met with a news crew for an interview outside the home to discuss the crime. One of the reported squatters appeared outside during the interview and left the home's front door open. Andaloro and the news crew entered the house where they found one of the alleged squatters asleep and some of Andalero's personal belongings still in the house. You probably have seen it. "This is proving everything I said. This is my furniture. These are my curtains," Andaloro said on camera to ABC 7 as she entered the home. "Who are you, sir? Get out of my house," she was seen telling a sleeping man in one of the rooms of the house. The men reportedly called 911, and as you saw, and on Andaloro, as she called a locksmith to come over and change the locks. And of course, the cops took her away. Yeah, so there you go. Got to do that. Got to make sure, even though she showed them that she had the deed to the place. It's amazing. Just amazing. She showed them proof of ownership. They wouldn't listen to her and they took her away and left the squatters there. Now, if anybody's mind is going to, as I mentioned, this whole immigration thing, we're going to hit on that Texas issue. That is the one that's actually breaking constantly over the past couple of days. It's permutating. Give us some interesting information on that. We'll get the first blush flash information then we'll dig down a little deeper into this thing. But in addition to that, one of the things I want to mention to sort of dig down in the next levels on this and participate with you is this. You've got public places now that people thought were designed and that they had raised the money to create for a particular purpose, like the school in New York, where they took the kids out of the school to bring in the emergency illegal alien migrant, whatever, the people who are getting subsidized by the federal government to come here. And the federal government is now paying for them to have $1,000 debit cards, $10,000 debit cards in New York. So like I said, just pretend you have a foreign language, go over there, and perhaps you too can get the $10,000 debit card. And then they moved these people during a storm a few weeks ago, or a couple months ago now, into a school in Brooklyn. And a woman was not too happy about that. In Boston, they were housing them at Logan Airport, you know, because national security, TSA, very important to make sure that, you know, people have to show all their IDs, got to be biometric. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. No, if you pretend you're from a foreign country and don't have any ID, then you'll get free food, free shelter, free legal, free medical from the state of Massachusetts. And also, since the state of Massachusetts has requested money from Alejandro Mayorkas, then you'll get it from other taxpayers from other states, because the governor of Massachusetts, Maura Healey, loves you so much that she wants to make sure that you will pay and other people from, oh, I don't know, Hawaii will pay. Yeah, that sort of thing. So it's all great. It's all collectivism. And of course, since collectivism never actually operates, because it doesn't actually allow people to determine what they find valuable and where would they want to spend their money to reveal their preferences, so the market can cater to those things, they just subsidize what they want politically, of course. Well, since that happens and it always fails, it has to keep expanding. So welcome Hawaii to Massachusetts. Glad you could be part of Logan Airport. So since that time, of course, people are saying, isn't that almost, maybe they're not saying it, but I'm pretending they're saying it, isn't that almost like a form of public squatting? How do we handle that? You're literally moving homeless people into Logan Airport, and you're buying homeless people from outside the United States. Now, again, I'm a libertarian anarchist. I'm a voluntarist. As I've stated before, philosophically and logically, a politically determined barrier is not a determined barrier. It's an imposed wall or a line in the sand that they have drawn politically that actually is impossible to say actually shows that anybody wants that barrier there, because the politicians aren't spending their own money on it. And the people who are forced to pay for it, they might all have different opinions. And of course, they're going to take private property to put it up there. The other part of it is the part I'm going to get into in more detail in a little while on the immigration front, which is, of course, that the word immigration doesn't appear in the U.S. Constitution. So we'll go into that and describe how that fact has brought about a massive, massive on-the-ground battle in Texas, something that I could kind of figure was going to be coming when I gave lectures on how it's not a federal purview, it's a state purview. I could see this conflict between the southern states and the feds, you know, members of southern legislatures, residents there getting upset because the feds weren't handling it right. And then finally, maybe thinking that they might finally recognize what's actually written in the Constitution and what the courts have done over the years to usurp that and blur the lines on things to put it into federal hands. The more dissatisfied people became on the state level, the more I started to think there's a chance that people might actually start to recognize the argument that I've been putting forward for, I don't know, like 10 years or more. So we'll get into the details on that a little bit more. But on the squatting issue, I think this issue in Queens does open up this question to people of, hey, am I not being forced to pay for somebody else to be housed somewhere now? Isn't that sort of like the woman who owns the property in Queens? And now her property, and she's paying taxes on it. She paid the upkeep. She paid for the place. She's got the mortgage on the place. She's paying for it. Somebody else is living there on her dime. Isn't that what they're doing at Logan Airport? Isn't that what they're doing all over the place? Whether it's a $10,000 debit card in New York, or it's people getting free housing in Logan Airport. And the amazing thing that Howie Carr, the radio host, brought up, and he's on at 3 o'clock in the afternoons on like 150 stations, but based around Boston. Howie's been a long-term journalist in the Boston area. And he noted, you know, they opened up this children's recreation center that, of course, they took tax money to build. And they said, oh, this is going to be good for kids in the winter. They'll be able to, you know, play basketball and do running and inside and so on and so forth. It'll be a good place for kids to come. That was their argument. Of course, as an anarchist, I say, how can you morally justify telling somebody, even if it sounds good, that you're going to forcibly make them pay for it? If you think it's a good idea, open up a charitable organization, try to start it that way, or start a business and see if you can make a go of it. Get advertisements. Say, we want to start this thing for kids. They don't do that because they put out the artifice, of course, that it's for the vulnerable kids, the underprivileged kids. And yeah, kids, you like kids. Who doesn't like kids? Well, a lot of people don't like kids, evidently, the way they treat future generations in so many ways, not only making them debt slaves, but who doesn't feel some sort of affection for thinking, okay, let's do something good for kids, right? But that's not doing good for kids. You can't do good for the kids without doing wrong against somebody else when you're doing it through the polis. And that's just axiomatic. You can't escape it, right? So they moved the original batch of people from Logan into this place in Roxbury, a very downtrodden area of Boston near Southie and stuff like that. And of course, since I said they moved the first batch, they said that they were doing it to clear people out of Logan Airport, clean things up at Logan. No, they just replaced them with more that they shipped in, thanks to Alejandro Mayorkas and Maura Healy, right? Can you say her name the way you say Alejandro Mayorkas' name? Maura Healy. I guess it does not quite the same. So those things being stated, I think there is that argument about squatting. But I think there's a greater argument about squatting, okay? This just goes towards the complete, utter lack of respect for private property. Now, since I didn't get to do the show last night, I didn't get to talk about this issue. So I had a few things saved up, a few things reserved that I want to express to you. Get your feedback on these in the next break here. And then I obviously know that David Knight yesterday spoke about this and did a fantastic job. So well-researched, so erudite, you know, just terrific. You know, very, very honest about what he says and knowledgeable. Well, he had on his Twitter/X feed about 24 hours ago that he posted this. Squatter stealing homes. When laws don't matter, neither do deeds. It's not only New York. Just like illegal immigration, government won't do anything about people who trespass or take over your home. And you'll see here over on his Twitter/X, he has the Zero Hedge version of this story. There's the owner of the property there. Let me raise that up a little bit. And he started off, did a great job covering this. One of the things that I brought up is this, and this is sort of the final point I want to make. Now, if you're watching, you probably already saw a glimpse of it, but if you're listening in audio, this is what I wrote. I said, and it's not a response to David, it's just a general statement, and I think it's a truism. The state is the ultimate squatter over all of us and our God-given natural rights to ourselves, our property, the fruits of our labor, our freedom of choice, freedom of contract, freedom of association and speech. Flurries of so-called emergencies and fancies of their personal utopias and new phases of fascism and new modes of fear-mongering all claim residence in our lives, plans, and souls. Resistance is ordained. Let's have resistance rather than government residence. And that is what it is. Once they make the argument that the state can command you to pay for the state for your own protection, well, they're squatting in your life. I think that's irrefutable. I think it's slightly philosophical. I think it puts a little twist on some of these squatting stories, but that's what we got. Let's turn to Rockfin and Rumble Chat and also welcome the folks at X. Thank you so much for being there, everybody. Lieutenant Oracle of Truth says, David Knight is my compass. Couldn't have said it any better. Boy, he's awesome. And that wheelbarrow thing, if you haven't seen it, his discussion about visiting Niagara Falls and talking about the man, the tightrope walker in the wheelbarrow and, you know, translating into having faith in Christ was just the first time I heard it. I was like, I got to play that for other people. That is profound. He is a real deep thinker. Freegan says, I'd take the $10,000 debit card, fly to Hawaii, and collect that juicy was at $63,000 a year welfare. Freaking man. Yeah, but first you got to get across the Canadian-U.S. border, right? They got you stuck up there. We got to get you down here from. You're near like Toronto? Yeah, right. I think so. Yeah, and again, thanks for the card, man. I got to send you something. And of course, we know that the government's going to inspect it. Over at Rockfin, drop your chats, chat concepts over there. And I appreciate it very much. It's funny because someone has a comment here about Rousseau. Yeah, you know, it's amazing. The collectivists, they all, I don't know if it pertains to that or something else, but the collectivists, Rousseau had such an utter hatred of private property that when he issued his first discourse on inequality, he basically said, the first person to plant a stake in the ground and say, this is mine, was the originator of all the problems. And for Rousseau, the problem was social inequity, class inequity. And one of the major reasons for it, get this, was because he wanted to join the highfalutin salons where Voltaire was speaking and, you know, things like that. But they wouldn't really allow him in. And he kept trying. He couldn't become one of the, you know, the stars of the intellectual elite around Paris. So he rejected that. He got real upset about it. And get this, Rousseau, check this out. Rousseau gave up every one of his kids. He was never legally married. He had a relationship with a woman who was slightly older than he was and had five kids, maybe six, but I think it was five. Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, had five children. He gave them all up to the foundlings home. And then, get this, the guy had the gall to write a long-suffering victimization status polemic about how he had never been able to experience the warmth of his child's embrace, that he was basically fatherless, and he blames society. It's like Repo Man when one of the characters gets shot and the main character goes up to him and the guy had taken the wrong path while the main character's cleaning up his life. And the guy's lying there on this convenience store floor bleeding out and he's coughing and stuff. He goes, I know a life of crime led me to this sorry fate. And he's got the blood packets in his mouth and he's clearly, you know, spitting it out obnoxiously just because it's a farce. And he goes, but I blame society. Society made me what I am. And Emilio Estevez playing Otto, the main character, says, that's BS, man. You're a white suburban punk just like me. And the guy's like, but it still hurts. And he starts coughing up blood and Otto pats him on the shoulder. He goes, you'll be okay, man. And he walks away as you see his Doc Martens walking away. He goes, or maybe not. Yeah. Classic. What a great movie. Thank you, Michael Nesmith, for funding that film. Oh, man. I got to yell out one time to Mike Nesmith. I said, thank you for Repo Man. And he goes, oh, man. And he quoted a line from it. And I quoted one back. And he slapped his leg so hard. It made me feel good that I got to get Mike Nesmith smiling and laughing and show him appreciation for the risk he took for that movie. Good movie. If you haven't seen it, check it out. So that's the squatting part of things. Okay. Now let's go into a couple other very, very quick stories. This one out. I think you'll find this curious, interesting, perhaps, I hope. And you can check out my Sunday News Assembly for a bunch more stories, but let me give you, this one. Okay. This is the one about the Biden move and the Senate and the beef. This is the one that's a little bit surprising, but it doesn't really mean that Joe Biden's actually finding the pot of gold in his Irish heritage. And it's a bunch of principles and recognizing the Constitution. No, it's a political move because, of course, he wants to destroy American cattle ranchers. But it is interesting from a free market standpoint. And unfortunately, the free market argument should stand on its own, allowing competition, allowing consumers to get something for less, even if they choose to get it from outside their town or outside their state. It's good for them. They save money. It's not my place to tell them to make sure that they buy from somebody inside their town or do all the work on, you know, buy from somebody on their street. They should be able to save their money and utilize it in another way. If they can find somebody who does it cheaper, it's like finding a tool that will help them in their yard, an inclined plane. The cave people used inclined planes and they kept using them because they helped their lives. They reduced toil. So if you can reduce toil and have a little energy left over, a little money left over, that can then go to help grow the economy, as we constantly hear, with other people being employed in new areas that could never have been funded if we didn't get the opportunity to save that money, if we couldn't do what we wanted, work for less, get more for less toil, right? Well, constantly we see the regulatory apparatus, we see the energy prices that they incur on us, we see all of their proscriptions about this or that that we can't buy, whether it's raw milk or anything, just the associations we'd like to do on our own. We're not forcing anybody else, right? Nobody is forcing anybody to get some of the raw milk from the Amish farmer in Pennsylvania, right? But this is what they do. They say, no, it's too dangerous. The government has to step in. Government has no place to step in anywhere. Thanks for tuning in to Liberty Conspiracy on Free Talk Live.
If you want to move to the free state and you're looking for some real estate, well, I know a guy who's really great. It's the Realtor Mark Warden.
Now you can learn more about the awesome things happening here in New Hampshire in our march toward liberty in our lifetime. Our friends at Porcupine Real Estate are hosting a series of webinars to educate you on the expanded freedoms enjoyed by New Hampshire citizens. Reserve your seat today at move.freetalklive.com. Topics include gun freedom, medical freedom, and political freedom victories. They also have a couple on best practices for moving to the free state and finding housing. These webinars are super helpful and free to attend once you've registered at move.freetalklive.com. Visit their YouTube channel, Porcupine Real Estate, for videos from past presentations and sign up for upcoming webinars for free at move.freetalklive.com.
PorcupineRealEstate.com.